is the day of the sporting estate passing.
Over 100 years ago, the aristocracy and the nouveau riche flocked to buy Highland estates and turn them into private sporting paradises. In time, their owners hailed them as the bedrock of the Highland economy. To this day, no country in the world has such a huge fraction of its land devoted to hunting as Scotland. In that, at least, we are unique. But times are changing. Local communities attack estates' record in employment and social responsibility. Conservationists accuse them of overburning and of overgrazing the land with red deer, while there is increasing friction with hill walkers and others. Lord Pearson of Rannoch, a Highland estate owner, Martin Mather of the Worldwide Fund for Nature, that is the WWF, and Alistair McIntosh of the Isle of Aig Trust, which tried to buy its own community's island, are here with me today to discuss whether the sporting estate needs culled. Alistair, before we get down to the nitty-gritty issues, are there any general directions, any general ways forward in the Highlands in which you think we might all agree?
Yes, Dylan, I think that first of all we have to remember the past. We have to remember it so that we understand where we are at just now and can therefore revision the future which we want in Scotland. And that past is one of these sporting estates having been created as part of the Highland clearances, whereby between 100 and 200 years ago, roughly, some 500,000 of our people were forcibly or by indirect economic pressure cleared from the land, some of them even having the roofs of their houses set afire while they were inside. Having understood things in the pain caused by that context, we can then look ahead and say that for the future, two priorities emerge. Firstly, ecological restoration. There is abundant evidence that the carrying capacity of the land, the ability of the land to be productive, would appear to have been declining over the past 2,000 years, but particularly over the past 200 or 300 years, and therefore reconstituting the land, probably through the reintroduction of native forest species, is one step forward. And secondly, and integral to the first point, is the regeneration of human community, the upbuilding of vibrant, entrepreneurial, creative communities where people have the opportunity to live at least with the land, if not entirely from the land.
Lord Pearson, putting aside the historical side of that, what do you think of these two broad aims? They seem fairly reasonable, the restoration ecologically and of communities.
I very much agree that we've got to start where we are and go forward, rather than harking back too much to a time which isn't really the responsibility of any of us who are now alive. And I do also agree that the carrying capacity of the land has deteriorated. I suspect that started when the forest went on to the retreat, probably as early as the Bronze Age, and I imagine it's been on the retreat ever since. But I think there are other aspects there that are worth thinking about. I think probably the advent of acid rain hasn't done the ground any good at all, and that can be measured with its effect, certainly from calls taken from lochs and things to around 1850. Anyway, I mean, I certainly agree that the land is slowly becoming more impoverished, and I agree we should all do what we can to find solutions.
Well, Martin, you probably would accept Alistair's two broad points too, if you agree with them. What about this conflict between conservation in its wide sense of natural resources and the sporting estate and the way it's run now?
I think, first of all, we have to stop looking at estates as all the same. There are, I think, a broad spectrum of estate types, from at one end of the extreme, the estates which have been in the ownership of a family for many generations, and where the family both hopes that it will continue to be in their ownership for many generations to come, and which the family depends on for the bulk of its income. Well, at the other end of the extreme are the estates which are more or less the equivalent of the Mediterranean yacht, an executive toy with really no economic function for the owner. They're purely a leisure activity, a leisure resource. Looking at, is there a future for the sporting estate? There is no single answer. I would hope that the estates at the family ownership end of the spectrum would be amenable to change because it would be in their own best long-term economic interest. The estates at the other end of the spectrum require much more radical change. To look at the environmental problems associated with the sporting estate, certainly at the moment the evidence is very clear that deer numbers have got out of control because the estates have failed to recognise a problem, and because they have failed to recognise it, then failed to manage it. Now we all know the problem's there, we've now got to persuade estates to deal with it, and I would suggest that the family type of estate is more readily going to do that.
What about a very crunch issue like, say, red deer, which are preventing the regeneration of old Caledonian pine forest fragments? That seems to be a fairly clean-cut decision you have to go for there.
Oh, from an environmental point of view, it's very clear. We have about 1.5% of our native forest left in this country, and of that 1.5%, about 80% dying on its feet, and a large proportion of that due to overgrazing from red deer, though sheep have a part to play in this as well. And it is very clear, therefore, that the priorities of land use at the moment in the Highlands are wrong. We need to switch towards our national and international responsibilities. That does not necessarily mean throwing the sporting estate baby out with the bad environmental management bathwater.
I was very glad to hear, Martin, you mentioned the word sheep. And indeed, Drennan, in your original introduction, I noticed that you put a lot of the problems down to overgrazing by red deer, and I don't think you did mention sheep. This is one I think that the Highland sporting estate manager, certainly someone such as myself who doesn't actually have any sheep, does find, I think, an area where the conservationists tend to be a little one-sided and a little unfair to us. I've been trying to do some figures today, and it does appear that if we take the sort of area that we're talking about, which is for the Highland sporting estate, the sort of northwest and the northeast of Scotland, perhaps, there are something over 1 million ewes. During the summer, they would carry something like 1 million lambs with them. And the generally accepted figure for red deer in Scotland as a whole is about 300,000. So, from the point of view of grazing pressure and the damage that that is doing to the environment, I think we do have to put the sheep into perspective.
As one of the rogues.
Well, yes, and also I think if one looks at the input into the economy, the Highland economy and the Scottish economy, the best figures I can come up with are that the Highland estates, the deer forests, appear to be putting about £21.5 million at the moment into the Highland economy from private sources. None of that is taxpayers' money. They give about 2,000 full-time job equivalents. Now, just very quickly, if you want to look at sheep, on the other hand, if you take your million-odd sheep, odd ewes from the northwest and the northeast, they are actually costing the taxpayer about £30 million a year. They employ rather more full-time workers, about 5,600. So just on the figures side of it and the taxpayer's contribution and so on, I would say that the Highland estates aren't doing badly compared to the sheep industry. And my own feeling is that I think the sheep are doing more damage to the natural flora than they're usually given credit for.
Well, I tell you, Lord Pearson, I have two people here straining at the leash.
I imagine.
Because this is the myth or the reality, whichever it is, of the sporting estate as a bedrock of the Highland economy. Martin, what do you think of that?
The problem with the figures that Lord Pearson is presenting is they are year-on-year figures which ignore things which I agree are difficult to cost, like the gradual erosion of the natural environment. Now, as I say, it's difficult to cost that, but if you look at, say, the hill-walking industry in Scotland every year, which is something dependent directly on the quality of the natural environment, it's estimated that it provides something like £250 million a year to the Scottish economy. Now, if there is a balance of economic favour, it is very much towards the access and recreation lobby based on those figures. And as I say, the ones that are difficult to justify, difficult to quantify, the erosion of our native woodland resource. And there are certain areas, and the Cairngorms is perhaps the best one to cite, where it is very clearly red deer on sporting estates which are causing the majority of the damage. And in fact, Scottish Natural Heritage recently said that the major conservation issue in the Cairngorms was overgrazing by red deer. Now, I deliberately chose an example well away from where Lord Pearson owns land, where I'm sure the case would be very different, but we don't have as much evidence. Sheep are a problem. They tend to be more of a problem on the west coast. And remember, of the million ewes that you mentioned, first of all, many of them will be taken off of the hill and off of the most sensitive environments over winter. So the problem is a very different one, although I do agree that the sheep system is subsidised by the taxpayer.
Hallister, you're champing at the bit here.
Yes,
what do you think of it?
I think the other dimension in here is one of the human ecology of it, the extent to which a given land use links in with the human need for fulfilment in life. And whereas a crofter with a few dozen sheep will know each sheep individually by its face, will gain immense satisfaction and put a lot of work into looking after those sheep, and it will form a small component of the crofter's overall income. The great deer forests, and forest is of course a misnomer because these are wet deserts, treeless landscapes for the most part, are owned by, according to the 1973 figures, which are the most recent we have, that 1% of the population who owns two-thirds of Scotland. And therefore the amount of benefit, the amount of human fulfilment that is gained from having that deer land use is going to a tremendously small base of people compared with what the benefit of sheep is going to. Nevertheless, I would agree with the overall position that sheep grazing is as damaging as deer grazing when carried out in excess. I think it's a balance between sheep and deer that needs to be looked at more closely.
Do we think that sporting estates inevitably lead to land degradation?
Well, I believe not necessarily. I think it is possible with certain types of sporting estate to get them to manage their land well. A lot of it is education. I've heard the estate owners say they believe they have a problem with overgrazing because they've noticed soil erosion starting to take place. Now, soil erosion is the end point of many years of degradation. So there's a problem going on, which obviously the estate owner was not aware of because he hadn't had the right training. Given the right training, and perhaps things would change. Of course, the estate owner who lives in the west coast of America and is here for 2 months of the year is never going to see that.
Just to touch back on the figures, it is of course true that the most popular rural recreation in Scotland is hill walking and rambling. If one goes a little further and looks at the direct expenditure on countryside sports in Scotland at 1990 prices in Scotland as a whole, you are looking at 173 million. So while of course I accept that the rural recreation pursuits of hill walking and rambling are more popular and so on, all this, I think there's perhaps a bit more work to be done before we dismiss the contribution of countryside sports to the economy of Scotland as a whole, and most particularly to the Highlands, of course, where the contribution that it makes, the year-round employment that particularly the deer forests offer in the most remote of our communities, is an important and worthy element.
These figures, though, raise an interesting point, Lord Pearson, I think, don't they? Because some might say, yes, but even if you didn't have a sporting estate system as such, you would still have this revenue because you still have to cull the deer and so on. Somebody would still manage the grouse and somebody would still shoot them. I think maybe what Alistair's getting at, and he's saying that actually it's the estate system that leads to a kind of social inequity and deprives people of a rather more life-satisfying style way of living.
Well, I wouldn't accept that, actually. I mean, I don't think you'd get the contribution from the private sector that I've given you if the sporting element wasn't there. If you would prefer to see, I don't know, armies of civil servants going around in flak jackets, armed with Kalashnikov rifles, shooting the deer, on behalf of the state, at vast expense to the taxpayer, then of course that's another argument. All I'm saying is that, as it is at the moment, there is a substantial contribution, certainly going right down to the narrow issue of this debate, which is the Highland sporting estate of over £20 million. There's the taxpayer is subsidising the sheep to the tune of £30 million. The latter do as much damage as the former, in my view. Because even in the winter, the sheep do come down to lower range, and that is much range which is also valuable to the deer.
But of course, the sheep problem may be a separate one from the deer problem. But, I mean, Alistair, has Lord Pearson maybe picked you up the wrong way here?
No, I don't think he has. And
are you saying that there should be civil servants shooting the deer and not local community people?
Well, I mean, you know, what if you licensed poaching? What if you permitted local people?
Quite welcome in some parts of Scotland. Might get rid of a few more deer.
I mean, woe be it for me to say it as one inclined towards non-violence, but what if you indeed allowed the army to get set loose and have a bit of live target practice? There are ways in which you could control the deer population very cheaply.
But would that be as humane as it is at the moment?
If you had excellent shots, then it certainly would be. And that would be the criterion. At the same time, I've worked as a pony boy, I've worked as a gillie on estate. And on Lewis when I was growing up. And I can assure you I've seen some appalling shots.
Yeah, I agree, so have I.
Particularly the kind of people who come up and buy their holidays. Mm. The ones who I admired, I remember one man, Commander Bray was his name, who renounced shooting on the day when he twice wounded a stag. He decided he had lost his nerve, that he could not allow himself out in the moor after that, and I really respected that man. But I'd like to take up the point that was raised a moment ago about the psychological effects of estate ownership on a people, on a community. And this applies particularly in the crofting areas, where there are still quite large numbers of people resident, and I'd like to make it very clear that it doesn't apply nearly so much in the sort of area where Lord Pearson has his estate, where there are very few local indigenous habitants remaining. And this is that in a community, the more somebody puts themselves up, the more it pushes other people down. And once a people feel that there is somebody lording it over them, that they are vassals to a feudal superior, then that disempowers them in terms of taking responsibility for their own actions, taking responsibility and care of their own place. And I think that without realizing it, even the most benign landowner has an adverse effect on the development of a community.
So really, in essence, it's the state system, rather than the sporting side of it, you feel is giving that effect.
Indeed, and I mean, W.C. Mackenzie, who documented the history of Lewis, and various other commentators have extensively remarked on how the will of the people was literally broken at the time of the clearances. Their sense of being able to do anything to help themselves, such as they had before, was destroyed. And it seems to me that it is only in relatively recent years, only really in my generation, that we've started to see people recover their sense of cultural pride, recover their sense of entrepreneurship, and the potential ability to restore the ecology of the land on which they have been born.
I must say I don't have experience of the crofting communities, and so Alistair really must forgive me there. I can't really comment specifically on that, but I think I can comment on the question of service. I would have thought that service is one of the great human motivators, and by that I don't mean servile service necessarily to a landlord or to anything of that kind, but I think all of us give service. Starting at the very top of the human tree, and I agree that when people who are in positions of responsibility and so on, when they forget that, it's extremely uncomfortable for everyone. But I simply don't recognize the world that Alistair has described. I'm afraid it may be that I'm wrong, it may be I'm completely out of touch with people locally at home and so on, but I'd be extremely surprised. Of course, I appreciate that someone like me will inevitably have his enemies in any local community, but I think I've also got quite a lot of friends, and I'd be very surprised if the latter didn't outnumber the former.
Well, Salister's thinking mainly of the crofting community. Martin, WWF has quite a lot of dealings with Highland people now. Do you think what Lord Pearson is saying is true, that there isn't this feeling of servility among the state staff?
Well, I think the best thing I can do is illustrate it by a rather sad story I heard the other day of an estate not too far away from where Lord Pearson's land is, where a man had been employed to be a gamekeeper. He had upped sticks and moved with his family to the estate, was there less than a year, and the estate decided to dispense with his services. He was in a tight house. And he's been literally thrown out in the street with no comeback whatsoever. Lord Pearson mentioned partnership, I think. Well, there are two sides to a partnership, and there's one example of an estate having almost power of life and death over the poor people working for them and not fulfilling their side of the bargain. Now,
Do we know how the man performed?
I gather the only reason for him losing his job was because the estate had decided to change direction. It was nothing to do with the performance of the individual.
But I mean, there's other dimensions to this too. When we were unsuccessful in our bid to buy the Isle of Egg earlier this year, the BBC sent a team over to interview the islanders shortly afterwards. And whereas before that team went for Leslie Widdiff's Speaking Out programme on Radio Scotland, a number of people had agreed to be interviewed by the BBC about their feelings about land ownership on the island. Once it was revealed that the existing laird, Keith Schellenberg, had bought the place back for himself, nobody except the old retired doctor was willing to speak to the BBC.
I'm presuming that the old retired doctor had no dependence on
the laird. No dependence on the laird whatsoever. And all over the Highlands, and I mean, I understand this doesn't happen on Lord Pearson's estate from what I can make out, but in many parts of the Highlands, people are frightened to speak out. They are in fear of being themselves, of being communities, because of what the laird might think. And that's just not good enough in a 20th century democracy.
Do you believe some of that happens even with, say, a landowner with Lord Pearson's attitude, inadvertently even?
I've been quite close while I was growing up to a number of very benign landlords. And yet, tragically, I think that with many of them, in fact, possibly with all of them, people always distort what they're saying when they're speaking to money and power. It's not necessarily for your own sake. It may be for a relative of yours who's employed by them. And just never knowing which way things might go if the estate's fortunes start taking a downturn.
We started out agreeing at least that what the Highlands needed was ecological restoration and the restoration and reconstruction of human communities. We seem to agree in that. Then I wonder, where are we at? Have we advanced at all in consensus, or are we still as wide apart? Martin, how do you feel?
Well, I do feel, sort of standing back a bit, that we need to question quite a few things still. We seem to be in a situation just now where government, for want of a better word, accepts the status quo, accepts the sporting estate as the pillar of society, having failed to really recognise that people's perceptions change over time, society changes, and it's now much closer to the truth that people accept the place of our forests, they accept the need for better and more integrated rural development, and we accept the need for better conservation. If there is a conflict between any of those in the sporting estate, and in some cases I believe there is, then we should be questioning government about why do they still seem to be supporting the sporting estate as the de facto option.
Alistair, briefly, are you in accord with that? Is that broadly your position?
I think that the way I would like to see things taken forward is either the path of land reform in Scotland to put control of a community's land back into the hands of the community to which it originally belonged before the rise of the sporting estate, or as a more conciliatory way forward, landlords making major concessions regarding working in partnership, particularly creating resettlement and giving back good arable land to communities where there were young people wishing to work it.
Lord Pearson, can we give you the last word, since you're a bit outnumbered here?
It's extremely generous of you. I mean, I think that the Highland estate owner hasn't really done his PR very well. I don't think we've come into the open enough and said some of the good things we are doing now. I would take as an example that the recent passage of the SNH, the Scottish Natural Heritage Bill, through Parliament, when in the House of Lords an amendment in my name did set up an advisory committee so that people who had an SSSI put on them could appeal to that. And this did cause the most amazing outcry with what I would call the conservationist lobby. I would just point out, by way of sort of defense of what we did, that this amendment appears to have been a great success. Although we were told that a flood of appeals by the wicked landlords would clog up the entire system, I learn, in fact, there hasn't been a single appeal. And Sir Magnus Magnusson did say in Parliament the other day that he regarded the amendment as an unqualified success, that it had changed attitudes in the old NCC, Nature Conservancy. All the difficult problems have been solved at the local level, which of course is good. Likewise, I think the whole of that debate, the whole business of SNH coming into being, has changed the attitude of most Highland estate owners very much for the better. I think that SNH has a very good wind behind it, and I think it could do a lot of what Martin and Alistair are looking for. So I don't think we've got it all wrong, actually. I think we've got quite a lot of it right, and I'm pretty encouraged for the future. I think an opportunity coming for cooperation between all of us will be the impending new deer legislation, with which, for instance, I hope it will become possible for the Red Deer Commission to be able to insist on reducing deer stocks to protect the natural heritage, and also things like bringing the hind season forward so that estates and others can shoot more hinds more easily and thus reduce the population in those areas where everyone agrees there are too many of them.
Yes, and of course the hind is the key to this, because
absolutely
everybody thinks shooting is about the stag, but of course it's the hind populations that are the problem, and nobody wants to do that for sport.
Well, you've got a terrible dilemma, because if you do bring the season earlier and you shoot them in September, which is what I favour, you may occasionally have to shoot calves which are very young, and therefore the whole sort of Bambi syndrome comes into focus. But if we want to get the numbers down humanely, we've got to extend the season and we've got to get on with it.
Yes, and professional marksmen will do a good job for us.
Yeah, I hope so.
Fine. Well, thanks very much for that bit, Lord Pearson.
Not at all.
And I think... Well, Lord Pearson, Martin Mather and Alistair McIntosh, thank you very much.
Alan Watson was in the chair for the third and last of In the Country's Upland Debates. The series was produced by Christopher Lowell. Next Monday, a much longer look back into the history of the countryside when John Purser presents music from the wild, natural sounds that have inspired Scotland's music.